I'm Matt Hoffman, an educator at the National Museum of American History, and this is History Explorer, a podcast that lets you investigate questions about history along with our staff. Have you ever been in an exhibit and wondered how museum staff decide what to put on display? Or, along the same lines, have you ever been teaching and wondered which object would be best to use in a lesson? Well, we have a podcast for you. We'll be hearing from Richard Curran, the Smithsonian's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture, who just published a book entitled History of America in 101 Objects. I asked Richard about the role of objects in education and what considerations should be weighed in making object choices.
We live in a world of objects in a material world all around us. And I think when we're dealing with history, often people associate it with timelines and things long ago. It's a bit abstract. It's a bit hard to understand. Whereas when we're dealing with material objects, you're presented immediately with the kind of curiosity. You know, what is it? Where is it from? Who made it? Who used it? So I think in terms of pedagogy, in terms of kids trying to get a grasp of something, you know, you show a kid something, they're going to get involved in it. They're going to explore it. And then I think you can use the object as a way in to understanding its context, its makers, its uses, its impact, maybe in another time. So I think objects occasion the kind of curiosity in students to explore in a way that just ideas or language does not. There's going to be various perspectives in choosing those objects. What I try to do is make sure that I had covered the different eras of American history. So we have things from pre-Columbian times and colonial times and contemporary times. So, you know, really run the swath of American history. I also wanted to make sure I had different types of objects. So there's textiles in there, things like the AIDS quilt, and then there's things that are documents, and there's paintings and portraits. There's swords and guns, there's railroads and telegraphs, there's inventions. So I was trying to pick out a selection of objects that had a kind of range of choices that could be used to tell America's history. Again, recognizing that somebody else can choose a completely different set of objects and almost tell the same history. The object is really a way into history. I think the other one with the objects is when I was doing the book, I was thinking if I was a teacher, let's say I was doing a music class, where I was musically inclined. I could do a course in American history through the music in the book. I can start out with the Star Spangled Banner and what music, you know, the role music played in terms of giving Americans a sense of themselves and identity, to the music of the protest music's in there, to, you know, a rock and roll with Chuck Berry, to the protest music with Bob Dylan, to the music and song of Marian Anderson and what that meant to sing on the mall that Easter Sunday. So, you know, you could do the whole book. You could reorient the book. A teacher could pick out just those items that have to deal with music and have more than enough to occupy a classroom. On the other hand, if you want to deal with it through art, you can do it that way. If you want to deal with it a theme and just deal with those issues of democracy or civil rights or ideas with freedom, you could pick out those seven or eight objects. So I try to make it very much like a menu that teachers then could go into, and rather than being forced to do it in a particular way, can choose objects that would get at an approach to these themes in history that they wanted to deal with.
Richard's book clearly offers a lot of options for teachers, as well as some important lessons about deciding which objects to use. It's important to consider your content, whether it be microhistory, major historical events, overviews of an era, or larger themes in history. Ask yourself what objects allow you to access content while also aligning to your teaching approach. Lastly, give consideration to what inspires your students' curiosity. Is it an everyday object that would have been used, music, art, etc.? What will hook them into wanting to discover the story, the object's place in it, and the impact we're making on history by how we're dealing with this object in this time in history today?
Dealing with history is storytelling. And I think what I try to do in the book is tell stories about the objects. Now, one of those stories, of course, is the place that it maintained in history. You know, really, when was this created? What did it mean? What was its context? And so on. But the other things I'm trying to do is deal with, okay, how did these become objects of heritage? How did they why were they contested? How were they thought of? So when when I'm looking at the Maine bugle, I mean, the bugle from the USS Maine was put in a position of honor along with the steering wheel of that ship that went down in Havana Harbor at the beginning of the 20th century, that was placed in a, that was so patriotic. It was such a symbol of America. Well, over the years, it got further and further away from centrality as we recognized that maybe that policy of U.S. expansion wasn't, you know, wasn't the wisest. Maybe that's not where we were as a country. And so you kind of see the development of these objects, and they tell their own story. And so I try to do that with a number of things. Some of the objects are objects of contention. You know, certainly the Enola Gay was, in terms of our understanding of World War II, the dropping of the atom bomb, and then the display of that, of the Enola Gay at the Smithsonian. So I'm not only historicizing the past, I'm also trying to say, hey, we're making history today with these objects in terms of how we deal with them today.
The bugle from the USS Maine, the Enola Gay, and other iconic objects are clearly great objects for classroom lessons. Smithsonian images and interpretation from Richard's book helps bring these into the classroom. But we're also on the cusp of a revolution that will get these objects into the hands of students.
As we move toward the digitization and the 3D digitization of the objects in our collection, I'm hoping that a teacher anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, could push a button and print out, you know, the Wright flyer or Lincoln's hat or Dorothy's slippers. Now, when you're printing out the space shuttle, I hope you put the reduce button on. so you reproduce it in manageable size. But I think the technology holds a great way to get these objects, or at least facsimiles, in the hands of many, many teachers and students. That would be very exciting to me.
In fact, the Smithsonian just launched its 3D initiative. You can now view objects like the Gunboat Philadelphia, the Wright Flyer, the Lincoln life masks with a revolutionary level of control. Data sets from these objects are also available for download and can be used to print the objects out using a 3D printer. You can visit this website at 3d.si.edu. The 101 objects in Richard's book are a great foundation. There are many objects here that can be used to teach particular lessons in a variety of subjects: history, math, science, music. That said, he hopes this list will help teachers choose the objects that best suit their content and approach, whichever objects those may be. We encourage you to check out historyexplorer.si.edu or collections.si.edu to find objects. Richard also hopes teachers take it one step further.
But I would hope they can also use them as kind of templates for then kids bringing in what's important to them. Go home, look in your house and say, you know, what would I pick out if I was doing not the history of America, the history of me or the history of my family? How would I think about it in terms of these, and what objects would I pick out to tell stories? I think that could be very good in terms of language development, of narrative, kids developing narrative. And I think it could also help students develop an eye for things. Why is something attractive? Why is something important? What kind of questions do I ask about an object that could be so revealing of so much more? So I hope they could, you know, teachers could use this as kind of a template or examples.
So far, we've learned about how objects can be used in the classroom and how to go about selecting them. I asked Richard if he had any other advice for teachers.
Yeah, well, I would say for teachers, you know, take the book apart and reassemble it the way you wish. But I think, my wife is a first grade teacher. She's taught first grade, second, third, and fourth, and fifth. I've been the president of a local PTA of a school that, aside from the Smithsonian, that's been my cause in life. I believe very strongly in education and fascination. And for me, putting together the museum world and the education world is very important. That was important for me growing up. I'm a working class kid from New York City. My dad was a taxi driver and truck driver. My mom worked in the garment center. We had to earn our way through school and college. And to me, being able to go to those museums in New York and see things and have access to things that otherwise I wouldn't have was amazing. It really kicked off my curiosity. So I can understand how, and I hope, these objects, again, kick off that kind of curiosity in students. I hope it's not used in a doctrinaire way, and here's the eight facts you have to know about the cotton gin, you know, but think of it in broader terms would be my advice. And I suppose there's a few lessons I'd love people to get out of this book. You know, one of them is, you know, an appreciation and a curiosity about American history. I don't think it's taught that much. I don't think people know it that much. And as our country gets, I don't know, maybe more complex, more diverse, our attention spans shift, we really need to know our history. I mean, to me, that's such a bedrock type of principle for our country to be strong, for us to know who we are. It doesn't mean we have to agree about everything in our history, but at least to know who we are, where we are, you know, on this planet and in the universe. That's kind of probably useful. I think the second one is to really get a sense of interrogating the world around us and objects and ask questions about things. Sometimes we take the everyday as just given. So I think when people look at that original RCA TV, which is in the book, and then all of a sudden they notice, well, that doesn't look like a TV to me. And why doesn't it look like a TV to you? Because people watch those first TVs through a mirror. The tube would project out to a mirror and you'd be watching TV in a mirror. All of a sudden, the everyday doesn't seem so everyday. Like, why did they do it that way? You know? One of my favorites in that is the telegraph. You know, when the telegraph was first invented, and a lot of people were playing around with different types of inventions, just like with the sewing machine. I think in the book I talk about like 16 different sewing machines that people were developing that were patented all within a few years of each other, because often creativity and innovation come in spurts where a lot of people are working to solve a problem. And in hindsight, it seems obvious about the one that did, but while it's happening, nobody's quite sure, you know, what it's going to look like. And so people are experimenting around. Well, with the telegraph, there were various systems. I mean, about reading, you know, sending electricity through wires that would put water bubbles in water and be coded in alphabets and so on. The kind of solution was the Morse code, and the idea that you'd have these, you know, dots and dashes. But when it was first developed, you looked at the first ones; they're more like a fax machine. The first telegraph has a spool for basically a paper, you know, these long messages to be encoded in a piece of paper. And Morse didn't think of it, you know, that, well, after people had learned and internalized the Morse code, they wouldn't need dots and dashes to be printed on paper. They would just hear them. And so that aspect of the invention disappears very quickly in the development of the telegraph. So, you know, what seemed every day 1 year, the next year is not so obvious and changes. And I think it would be good if the book gets people to look at the material culture around them, again, whether major objects or minor objects, and just think about it. And think about, you know, like, why did they make it that way? Why does a light bulb go the way it does? You know, why does, why does a car have four wheels? The first car had three. So let's not take our world for granted, because I think in questioning that is room for creativity in the future. Creativity, innovation always comes because somebody looks at the world in a different way and sees something a little different. And if this book could help people see things a little different and invent something new, that would be great.
Thanks for listening, and thank you, Richard, for taking the time to interview with us. You can listen to more History Explorer podcasts at our website, americanhistory.si.edu/podcasts. Or simply subscribe to us on iTunes. Just search for History Explorer. This podcast is made possible through a generous grant from the Verizon Foundation. Music from the _Orchestra, which you can find at _orchestra.com.